PICA stands for, what we do. Obviously, this is a community group, and we really want to hear from you as property investors, the struggles that you're having, if you're having them, and you know, what is it that you'd like to see from PICA in terms of advocacy. The agenda for tonight, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, first and only speaker, Ben Kingsley, our national chair, in a moment to sort of talk through some of the advocacy work that PICA is doing. But then we'll, Corinne Bohan, who was meant to be joining us tonight, who runs a bit over 4,000 property management. She's a fantastic speaker. Unfortunately, her her father's come down very ill, and she was meant to fly down from Brisbane this morning but was unable to. So she has been good enough to pass on some notes for me. So I'll be able to run through some
this meeting is being recorded.
The changes we are seeing in property management legislation. And then at the end, we really want to hand it over to you for Q&A. Want to hear from you what you're feeling as property investors. And for the best questions, we've also got some books from Ben and Bryce, which I don't even know how you find time to be doing that. You wear a lot of different hats, amongst being the, you know, obviously PICA as a volunteer. Everybody here who's put on an event tonight are all volunteers. Everybody who works nationally across the board are all volunteers. And no one more so than this guy who's been doing it for, 12 years or something like that now?
Something like that.
Something like that, both with PIPA and with PICA. And then somehow manages to run the number one real estate podcast in the country as well. So to find time to do that, I'm not sure how. But best questions, there's a couple of free copies that we're going to give away tonight. And if you're lucky enough, you might actually get an autographed version of it. So, Ben, why don't we kick things off by let's talk a little bit about what PICA is doing in terms of advocacy work now. What are some of the major national issues we're seeing?
Thanks, Tim. And I just want to also acknowledge the Victorian committee that Tim does such a great job. And we've got Ben and Rakesh up the back in terms of being able to put this stuff together. I suppose where I want to start is it's become more and more evident to me in terms of someone who operates in this industry for the last 30 odd years that there was going to be significant changes that did occur around the property market. And so when I joined, I studied the QPA course for the Property Investment Professionals of Australia and then found my way on their board and then ultimately became a chair of that association. It was through that exchange and knowledge exchange and what was going on in that part of the trade side of the industry that as I was talking to more and more of the trade partners and so forth, is that we all agreed that, you know, we were going to see potentially legislative changes and all those types of things that was going on. And that sparked the interest in terms of saying, well, you know, PIPA is the trade association and they can speak on behalf of our businesses and, you know, hopefully encourage the professionalisation of our industry. But what we needed to also focus in on is who was actually going to represent the landlord or the property investor. And so with a bit of funding from PIPA, that allowed me to set the constitution up for the not-for-profit association, which is the Property Investors Council of Australia. And, you know, our job inside that council is to advocate for property investors, given changes in legislation that we did see coming, and try and make sure that those narratives and so forth remain balanced. And that's been the challenge. And it continues to remain the challenge as we see some of the legislative changes that are going through there. I think we can all agree that, you know, the vast majority of us property investors want safe and quiet enjoyment for our tenants in our properties. Absolutely. There are a small group of property investors who may not do the right thing by their tenants, and that's always disappointing. But you could also argue on the other side that there's also tenants that don't necessarily act and look after the asset and enjoy safe and quiet comfort of the property that they're leasing from us. So our job and our goal is to just try and basically make sure that the pendulum doesn't swing too far in the opposite direction, advocate, you know, from a lobbying point of view with government and work with the regulators to try and get that right. At the moment, that has been quite challenging. We haven't really, we've had a couple of wins. The biggest one was probably the coordinated effort out of Queensland, where we teamed up with the Real Estate Institute of Queensland, obviously PIPA and PICA, to have a look at that land tax legislation that was going to effectively judge all ownership of all land in Australia to set the land tax rate that you're going to pay in Queensland. So fortunately enough, that was a win. And we're starting to just build those relationships at the state level and also at the federal level. But it's clear with the current government in power that that they have had an agenda for the left side of the Labor Party to increase the protections for tenants. And some of those protections are, again, warranted, but others are overreach. And so we're trying to get the balance right in terms of how that legislation plays out. And so that's the fight that we do in that respect. On the other side of what we're trying to do with PICA is educate you to make informed decisions. And to, you know, if you're going to work with professional people in the industry, that you have the right, armed with the right questions to ask and understand basically, you know, whose interests they're working in. And hopefully it's in your best interest in terms of the work that they do.
Very good. I'm going to go back a little bit, Ben. Mm-hmm. You started PICA for a reason. It was to, you know, PIPA was obviously the industry body. Mm-hmm. PICA is, you know, representing us as property mm-hmm. investors. Why is it so important when you are talking to policymakers that it's coming from the property investors themselves and not so much the industry?
Yeah, that is a really, really good question. If I'm a property manager, my business is obviously keeping my customers happy, and those customers are us property investors, right? So when legislation does change, one could argue whether that property manager wants to tell you the bad news and wants to give you all of the truth in the risk that they might, you know, scare you into selling that property. And, you know, in terms of property management businesses, the actual commercial reality of property management businesses, they're difficult businesses to be in, but they sell on very high multiples in regards to every property that they have. So in Victoria, as an example, for each listing, it's worth between $6,000 and $9,000 of value to that property management business. And so when you've got the industry and potentially property managers who want to, you know, paint the story a little bit better than maybe what it is, you know, there may not necessarily be in the best interests of us as their clients in terms of that. Not to say that probably 80% of our interests are vested, but that 20% is important. And so, you know, if the government and the regulators are asking for insights and advice, I'm not sure that, you know, all of that bit of information that they'll be passing on will represent our interests in the best light. So that's an example of where it really is important that we have a direct voice. Mm-hmm. As the, you know, investors across Australia in residential property, we'd well and truly be over sort of $40 to $50 billion of investment every year into property across the country. And so they are enormous numbers, and we don't get the credit for that because at the end of the day, we're referred to as mum and dad property investors, or household property investors, whatever we want to call ourselves. But that investment is meaningful in future supply in the market. And of course, you know, based on our research, we know why most people invest in property, and that is to provide for themselves and their family and give them some security around that investment. And so we've got to marry that with also providing the public good in terms of allowing for tenants to have safe and quiet enjoyment of the asset that they're renting off us.
Mm. It's funny, I sit here as a rent investor, and yep. I can tell you in terms of how much legislative change has happened, it's, I can't believe how often I'm getting a call from detector inspector as a tenant. Right, just to have to go and have all of these different checks done, gas, electricity. Now, we're wearing that as a cost as a landlord, of course, but as a tenant, it's actually really frustrating as well. Now, that's just one tiny little change, but there's been something like 140 changes to Victorian legislation over the last few years. Where does PICA, or how can PICA sort of help assist in this advocacy fight? And why is it important that we do grow that membership base?
Again, really good points. Obviously, it's political, right, in terms of the reason why the Labor Party are doing these tenancy reforms is a couple of things. We need to always remember that they are good-willed, best intentions. They actually think, most of them, think that, you know, this is in the best interests of tenants in terms of the protections and the safety mechanisms that they put forward. So if it comes with a best intention, that's fine. But the political intention is also that you've obviously got the left wing and the right wing of the Labor Party. You've got the moderates, and then you've got the socialists. And they obviously compete with the Greens Party. And the Greens, you know, in terms of are a challenge for the Labor Party usually, this last federal election, but they are obviously trying to make sure that they're appeasing their base, which is a bulk of the sort of left leaning, and then the moderates who are more centralist and believe in, you know, economic prosperity and some aspiration, is what's going on there. So you've got a really strong faction of the left party trying to get negative gearing and capital gains reforms changed, because they honestly think that it's the property investor that's ruined, you know, the ability for Australians to own property. And that statement is not true, but there are elements of truth in the sense that we are part of the demand of wanting to own property in this country, and they will argue that that investors have turned property into a commodity. Okay, now I have a little fun story that sort of counterbalances that, that goes back to the formation of Christianity, and, you know, the fact that Jesus was born in a stables was because there was no rental accommodation available for him. And
A bit
so,
like here in Australia at the moment.
yes, a bit like here in Australia. So I tend to, I you know, it's not like renting out houses or apartments or villas or manors or any type of accommodation is something new. So we've got to be mindful of the truth in that statement. And coming back to the other part of the point that you were talking about, why is it important that we take on that as a group and a collective is because if we can organise ourselves into the 2.3 million investors that we are, that's a big vote in, you know, cohort. And so if we're organised and galvanised in that response, then the political parties have to see the unintended consequences of losing a vote and so forth. And I like the story here in Victoria about, I don't know if you're, I'm a little bit older than most of them, but the dredging of the bay. Back in the day, we used to dredge the bay, and it just destroyed the fish stocks to obviously collect the scallops and so forth at the time. And so a lot of recreational fisher people decided to organize themselves and put their little stickers on the back of the car and say, "I fish and I vote." And we were able to obviously get legislative change to stop the scraping of the bottom of the bay, and now we have a really good fishery, and it's been a benefit for that. So our view is, you know, if we can organise ourselves into a larger collective and get people active in terms of informing their local member or tweeting out or retweeting or sending a LinkedIn message to, you know, other people, and it feels a bit uncomfortable, right? Because we have this tall poppy syndrome in Australia, and this sort of, you know, you've got investment properties, you know, it's all right for you, but, you know, for these young people trying to get into the property market, it's a challenge. Now, I'm not saying it's not a challenge. I don't think that's fair to just say basically, oh, it's easy. It's not. But the point we're making here is it is about getting that balance right. And the same sort of thing, you know, where we welcome things like build to rent and potentially build to rent to own as part of the mix. But the reality is those types of commercial investments need a reasonable volume, i.e., it's unlikely you'll get a build to rent model for townhouses, but you'll get them for medium and high density. as part of that, because just the economics don't really work that well. So there's people out in the marketplace who choose to rent, who are experimenting in terms of markets that they're coming into and so forth, and or you know want to leave the nest and go and you know spend a year or two with their mates and you know house sit and all those things. So there is a cohort of the marketplace that we still believe that you know needs to have a free market mechanism to be able to accommodate those, and so off the back of that, we're trying to make sure that again we get the balance right between the legislation and you know we have a sustainable property investment industry and marketplace, because what you also need to understand about the mechanics of an economic marketplace is human mobility and human capital is essential for economic growth. So if you can't move that human capital at a cost-effective way quickly for any you know sort of seasonal or growth of a town or city or region or whatever, that's going to limit the economic growth, and off the back of that, that's going to have impacts on jobs and on living standards of Australians. So that's the other part of the blend that we're not seeing in the narrative at the moment. So our job is to change this narrative from greedy property investors. And I don't think that, you know, I'm rabbiting on a little bit here, but
no, you're fine.
I don't think that the narrative of the mum and dad property investor is going to continue to win the pub test. One of the narratives that I've encouraged people to pick up on is that we are private rental accommodation providers, and we're in the business and we're running these small rental accommodation businesses. And so if the government or the public see us as small business owners, all of a sudden we take away a bit of that sort of narrative and power away from the greedy property investor who's about to buy their fifth or sixth property, when the data suggests 72% own one and 90% own a maximum of two. So I think it's important that we continue to keep, you know, that narrative real to be able to, you know, tell our story.
Yeah. That's a good point. I think, you know, over the years, what PICA has been able to do, and certainly through the help of what PIPA has been doing at an industry level as well, is give us a seat at the table, which never used to happen, but we get a seat at the table when they are thinking about changing policies or putting forward new legislation. So that's why it's important that we do have a voice, not just from the advocacy perspective, but that narrative that you talk about. You know, there's something like 3.3 million rental homes in Australia, and we supply 90% of them as private rental accommodation providers. Yet in the media, we're the villains, and not just in media, but you know, in I think in a lot of the government's eyes as well, they're really quick to jump to the tenants' defence, and you know that's what helps with elections. If you look at the most recent federal election, there was absolutely nothing on the supply side. We keep on talking about this huge housing crisis we're in. But when nothing in the federal election budgets were to suggest that we could actually help create new homes, it's all about making it easier for you to buy something that's pre-existing. So there's a lot of work that we need to do to ensure that we can change the narrative around what a property investor is, and it is us who is actually providing rental accommodation. And Ben, I wonder whether you might wanted to quickly talk to, you know, the other side of the advocacy, which is government-backed and helping tenants. What's happening there?
Yeah, so I might pick up on a couple of the points. In some of the legislation that was proposed, a lot of people did talk about that the majority of that legislation was demand, and that is true. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, if you want more first-time buyers to come into the market, you've got to create demand for them and you've got to incentivize that. I think some of the policies whereby the tax concessions or the tax rebates that were offered by the Liberal Party, that was only on new builds. And so everyone still saw that as a demand side, but at the end of the day, they weren't touching existing property. So you couldn't take advantage of it unless you actually added to supply.
Yeah. But also the median price of a new build now as well, people can't afford. So
no, and I think, and the other one that I also thought was reasonable policy was, it's the last mile of services to release the lots that's really important. So it's the civil works and all of those types of things. So, you know, you were talking about one of the parties was offering $5 billion. The other one's offering $500 million for effectively shovel-ready works. That would have definitely added to the supply or release of new land. And look, we know developers will release land in stages to create artificial scarcity and balance right as well. So there are a couple of things that the political parties now, obviously we know we've got Labor and we might have them for a little while. So if we talk to their policies about the 5% deposit, that's obviously very much demand side. And I think, look, at the end of the day, the deposit is one of the areas that is the biggest challenge for getting people into market. So I don't mind that. The shared equity schemes were also, I was a big fan of, in terms of allowing people to potentially buy in areas where the government would take an interest in, and over time you would see them buy that out. I would have liked to have seen that as being sort of, I suppose, isolated in a sense that all of the future profits that get made from that, you know, so it's basically self-serving as potentially those owners either sell and the profit goes back to the government. So to be able to do that, I think, is a reasonable thing. In terms of other legislation which might take a bit of pressure off the housing crisis, one of the ones that Bryce and I talk a little bit about is with your principal place of residence, there are some small concessions you have if you've got a student or international student into your property, and there's a certain amount that you can reclaim as a sort of a maintenance fee or a what's the word I'm looking for? Board for that property, and that doesn't impact your tax concessions on your principal place of residence, your capital gains. But I would have thought potentially a 3 or 5 year program where you could rent out a room, and that in itself would take a bit of pressure off the rental market in those particular circumstances if it didn't impact their capital gains event. But I have it as a limited period to then, you know, because at some point in time, we will get this supply thing solved. We'll start to see some absorption happen and we'll get back to a little bit more balance. But what you have got is, you've got state governments who are absolutely wedded to the tax revenue. I don't know whether you saw the Victorian state budget yesterday.
I actually took a screenshot of the Herald Sun today. What was their quote today?
47% of all taxes collected by the Victorian government is property related.
Jacinda Allen calls it, it's all part of Victoria's nation-leading fiscal strategy. We've got more debt in this state than every other state combined, but it's...
they had a crash in economy. So I do worry about that a bit, actually, in terms of... because at the moment, what they're doing is they're making running business in Victoria really difficult. Even the fire levy has increased by 100% on all residential and commercial properties. Now, that's tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of additional cost that they're collecting. And obviously, it's all about consolidated revenue to justify their spending addictions. So that's problematic. And if I was starting a business in Australia right now, I would not pick Victoria.
No.
And not even remotely think Victoria would have.
Jump in on something we've talked about there in the same line as this is that unintended consequences that we keep on seeing. They're making these knee-jerk reactions. And a lot of the time in our space, they're making these knee-jerk reactions in terms of trying to protect the tenant. And then all of a sudden, as property investors, we say, well, if you're going to make it hard for me to own real estate here, then I'm going to take my money elsewhere. And it looks like Victoria doesn't want our money the way things are at the moment.
Yeah. And so back to your point about how do we show examples of, you know, how bad this legislation is. We saw the bond data be released for December quarter. So we're now 24,848 less rental properties in Victoria in the last 12 months off the back of, you know, the overreach that's occurred.
Yeah.
Now, they'll spin it to sort of say, and look at, we've got the leading number of first home buyers entering the market because we've stopped the investor coming in and that's slowed down property prices. I was interviewed by a journalist from the ABC about that because I've advocated that it's going to continue to keep see rents continue to increase as that pressure puts on. And, you know, typical sort of ABC reporting, it was saying that the so-called risk of higher rents wasn't actually materialising. And so I actually had to write back to him and say, that's not factually correct, and here's the data to support it. So he pulled the data from CoreLogic, or Cotality, as they're now called. And that is definitely showing that rental increases are easing, and there are some marketplaces where rental increases are flat. But what we did also see, and what wasn't reported in there, is there's reportedly 42,000 less international students that aren't currently participating in Victoria, or in mainly Melbourne, education at the moment. And that 42,000 is meaningful. And if they had been also competing for that rental stock, there's every chance that, you know, that the rental story in this state will get worse. And I am literally, any person I get to tell, if you actually compare Southeast Queensland, sort of Sydney metro area, Perth metro area, and even Hobart, we're about 10 to 15% under market rent for comparable assets. So we've either got property managers who are a little bit lazy in sort of saying, you know, don't upset the cartwheel, because they've got that difficult balance of trying to keep, you know, the client, the tenant happy. But it's clear to me that we need to lift our rents in Victoria, and we need to lift them, and we need to, you know, make that statement. Because if the narrative gets out that rents don't actually increase, and we can do this, I'll keep doing it. Now, and at some point in time, it'll catch up, and the market will realise that. But if you're, to your point, for every one of those 6 months where I've got to do my gas and my fire, and I've got to do all of these minimum standards, and then I've got, obviously, you know, my land tax and all of these other state-based costs that are being part of running my business from a compliance point of view, you know, at the end of the day, if I'm just collecting rent and passing that on to government, it's not going to make for a viable investment.
Mm.
So that again, that's why rents have to move in this state. And coming back to that message, you know, if there's, what, 25, 30 of us here with that message, and we can, at a dinner party, or, you know, talk to someone about that, and they get that message on and so forth, and that message spreads. And, of course, I spoke about it on the podcast, which will come out tomorrow afternoon. I talk about the rental, the bond yields collapsing, continuing to collapse, and also that rents are under market. Hopefully, when you do get to talk to your property manager and they say, oh, look, you know, maybe leave it as is, say, no, look, let's put another $20 off a week, or whatever it may look like.
Well, you still can.
Well, yes. Well, look, that will be the death knell. And one of the, you know, I'm going off again on a little bit of a tangent, but Albo did a podcast with the AFR in the lead up to the election, and he's made it really clear that negative gearing's off the table, because what he doesn't want to do, and this is the good side of...
It's because he just bought an investment property there.
He had to sell a few of them to pay for his new owner-occupied, which is tax-free.
Yeah.
But the point being is that he does believe in aspiration.
Mm.
So as long as we've got a prime minister who, if they're true to their word and they believe in aspiration, that's part of aspiration.
Surely there's got to be some logic in there as well, that they realise that negative gearing is a moment in time. Like, we don't get this tax back forever. Like,
no, we'll be paying tax once it's positively geared. That's right. So,
and off the CGT as well, later when you start.
Oh, a huge amount. Like, yeah. You know, the numbers on, again, which go unreported, because unfortunately the ATO data doesn't show the separation between commercial and resi. So when they report on the capital gains revenues, it's $37 billion in 2022 tax season, right? That goes unreported. All we get is this Treasury reporting that there was $23 billion of negative gearing benefits paid out, or, you know, a tax foregone, as they call it, Treasury, because they're only interested in collecting tax.
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, misinformation. And I think one of, you know, if anyone's thinking about doing a thesis or a PhD on this. I've got a topic that I'd love them to do it on. And that is that our tax system is heavily favoured, not for property investors, is actually incredibly heavily favoured for owner occupiers. Right? The system is absolutely in favour of those. But I want to look at the economic benefit to society and the living standards of all of the 60 somethings who are downsizing or starting to spend that money in the economy, in the restaurants, in the regions, in the hospitality areas, in the caravans, the four-wheel drives, all of the things that they're spending the kids' inheritance on, right? What economic advantage to GDP is that?
Yeah, it's huge.
Because, these people who believe in social democracy, what they are actually saying is that we're going to stop aspiration, we're going to stop all of that spending, and ultimately it just slows the economy down, and you just get, and slower employment means worse living standards for all. So I just want people to understand that there is trillions of dollars that are available into our baby boomers at the moment, and they're spending it.
And there's a reason those big entrepreneurial unicorn businesses set up in the US. They're capitalists, and they make it work.
Yeah. I do like most of the system that we've got. I'm a free market operator. I do believe in, and I believe in smaller governments, but I think when you start thinking that the market can fix itself, greed will step in somewhere in that program, and I think it's just important that we have some sort of guardrails up, but the bulk of the regulation that we're putting in is stopping productivity and is stopping economic growth more generally.
Yep.
And, like there's a couple of things I can tell you about productivity, because that's my big theme for this year. I just did a podcast on it on Tuesday. We've got the worst productivity that we've had in the last 60 years as a nation. If we look at building properties, i.e. building residential properties, we haven't had any productivity gains in the last 18 years of building residential property. Now, the Productivity Commission has done reports based off the back of this. I'm going to make sure I've got this data right. I'm trying to recapture my slide. But the Productivity Commission account for 80% of the increase in incomes and living standards in the last 30 years in Australia, all off the back of increased productivity. So if you don't increase productivity, you don't increase the ability to earn, because usually what happens if you increase productivity, some goes to the company, some goes to the shareholders, and some go to the workers, right? That's how it should work. Mm-hmm. Right? And it should be meritocracy based. So if I'm producing well, then I should be able to earn more. Mm-hmm. And that's basically how an open market system works. So I'm interested to see, because the Treasurer has made a bold statement that that's his focus also for this term of government. So if we do increase that productivity, that means that it won't, we'll see improvements in terms of the speed at which we build new properties, because that is the red tape and all of the other sort of regulatory changes that we have to the building standards codes has meant that everything just costs more, okay? And we can't get a run-up at building, modular homes, 3D printed homes. This is coming, but if you keep changing the building code legislation, all of a sudden, you've got to redo, and it just doesn't make sense. So there's a lot of areas that we can go after that will help with better economic activity, lowering the cost of construction, and what won't lower, in my view, is land prices. The only way land prices will lower over the longer term is the destruction of economic activity in that particular location. So if you have a town that fails, you have cheap land. You have a town that booms, your land continues to keep growing. And in fact, I haven't mentioned this before. You're going to be the first to ever hear this out of my lips, because I'm doing a masterclass soon next week. There's a research report from a professor, Jeffrey, and I've spent a long day. I can't think of his last name, out of Santa Fe University. And his specialty is biological organisms, but the economic look at those biological organisms and so forth. So he did a study on cities. And that study on cities and large cities yielded some really fascinating facts. The big facts out of that particular study was that wages are 15% higher in our bigger cities. Wealth is 15% higher in our bigger cities. And the only byproduct of that, unfortunately, is crime is also 15%, you know, more pronounced in that. But it sort of makes sense, right? Because when you think about the organism that is a city, it has consumers in that city. It has knowledge workers. It has, you know, innovation. You know, you're trying to build that dynamacy in terms of trying to bring all of those things together. And when you get all of that together, you create things and you create economies, and it's just done on a greater scale.
Yeah.
And the people who are creating it and the most productive people in that economy get paid the most, right? And then ultimately in the smaller towns and so forth, that just doesn't happen
yeah.
at the same scale. So regional prices will always be a byproduct of what happens in terms of the pricing and affordability of our bigger cities. And I think that that should be known. If you're investing for the decades, you should be thinking about that. The other thing that you should also be thinking about is that how we express ourselves as human beings is through how we dress, the jewelry, the cars we drive, the things that we acquire. But one of the big things that we show off with is our property. And so we do have this love affair with this idea of, you know, the status that comes with success. And that's magnified through social envy platforms, right? That's social media, but I just call them social envy platforms. And so the part of that story is just one of, so when you got the Gold Coast, like, you know, I was talking to one of our buyer's agents the other day, and he was asking me, you know, what's a typical house, you know, 800 metres back from the beach in Broadbeach worth these days? And I said, oh, I don't know, maybe two and a half. He's gone, no, try about 4.5 to five, and the good ones are about six. And it's like, well, that productivity isn't happening in the Gold Coast.
No.
Like, you know, in terms of where that money's coming from, it's coming out of those bigger cities. But
you can thank Dan Andrews for that. They all left.
But we do express ourselves in the properties that we own, right? And if we continue to have the blocks and all of these other shows and all of this sort of transformational shows, that is true. And so you will get Byron, Goldie, Noosa, and you know, even let's call it Portsea, and all of these sort of show areas and status areas, people buy into that stuff, right? Mm. And the land gets expensive, and the prestige and the uniqueness of that, and that also has a ripple effect. And so when you're an investor, you're trying to look for where that investment's going to come from, where that scarcity is going to come from, and you just want to take a parcel of that land and let all of that magic happen around it.
Yeah.
To ultimately get your biggest return. And if that's working properly, then your rent should also go, because there's also a lot of people who rent best or whatever, who want to be in the best locations, give their kids the best opportunity, but don't necessarily want to buy there.
Mm.
And so they need product. And so the rent is at a premium in those better locations. And that's the, you know, that's the sort of mindset of investing over the decades. I went off on a big tangent there, didn't I?
That's okay. I'll remind you of the question I initially asked you in a minute.
Did I actually answer it?
No, yeah, but we will get there. So I've got some notes from Corinne, and as I mentioned, anyway, came in a bit late. Corinne Bohan runs Image Property, and they're a tremendous outfit who have got over 4,000 properties, and she's just a world of knowledge. So I'm going to not do her justice here, but she has given me just a few notes that I'll share with you. So what she's sort of expecting to see in the near future is most states are moving to prioritize tenant security and affordability. These are obviously politically driven pressures, and it's because of the growing renter population. Reforms are becoming more tenant favourable, and this is unlikely to reverse. Sort of segue back to the question of what's the name of the group that is acting on behalf of tenants now that are really getting their skates on?
Oh, I forgot the name of them. Yeah, is it NORA?
NORA.
The National Organisation of Rental Associations or something like
Yeah,
that.
that's right. So they're obviously government backed and really in place to sort of support, tenant rights. And as Ben, quite correctly said at the start of tonight, we're not suggesting for any moment that we don't want them to have a safe and quiet enjoyment of their property. But I don't know about how you all feel, but not everybody needs to own Tesla shares, but we all need a roof above our head, right? I didn't choose Tesla shares. I chose property investment, but I'm losing a lot of control as a property investor. And, they don't do that with other asset classes. And I think what's got to be taken into consideration here is, when we choose to put our hard-earned money into an asset, we need to maintain some control, and that's what we're advocating for. So key takeaways for investors are rent increases are going to be limited, not just per lease, but per property, as seen in Queensland. If you're not familiar, it's not just on the tenancy, it's also on the actual property itself now in terms of when and how much you can put up.
So just on that point, so how it works in Queensland is if you increase the rent on your previous tenant in, say, I don't know, the 17th of November last year, and your tenant gives notice to vacate, you put your new tenant in and the agreement will read that this is the rent, but on the 17th of November, it increases by X.
Mm.
So you can't make that change for the change of tenant. You've literally got to basically put that policy in place.
Which causes all sorts of problems. If you get a contract to sale for a property that you're looking to buy, it'll have the lease in place stating what the current rent is, but then all of a sudden if a tenant moves out, it's vacant possession, I go and advertise it, I have to advertise it at the previous rate, only to jack it up 2 weeks later. That might be the case. So it's causing a lot of issues and obviously a lot of hard work for property managers. Rent bidding's now banned in many states, removing price competition between prospective tenants. Eviction protections are tightening, with no grounds terminations removed or restricted in many states. Ben, did you want to touch on New South Wales no grounds evictions? It's been a big one.
Yeah, it's definitely, this one's been a tough one. We didn't win anything in this particular debate. So as of, now I'm thinking, what time frame?
June, July?
No, it was Monday, 19th.
Mm.
Was the 19th. So the new tenancy laws came into practice in New South Wales. And so they're referred to as reasonable grounds, but the reasonable grounds are that you're selling the property, that you're moving into the property, that you're significantly renovating the property which creates it to be uninhabitable. An immediate family member is moving into the property. So in other words, it can't be, even if it's a loved one or someone very close to you, if they're not immediate family, they can't move into the property. And of course, if the tenant creates has had a serious breach of their tenancy contract, and that's very hard to prove, and they get multiple, sort of warnings, but that's always very difficult. So what a lot of people are missing in that legislation is that if you've got a fixed term or a periodic lease, and you're thinking, oh, that's great, the lease is about to come up, so, I'll say thanks, but I'm not going to renew your lease. It's been good, but, we've had a few run-ins, but it's not necessary.
You're always paying late, whatever it may be.
They can't be removed. So the tenant can stay as long as they like, except for those reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also now pets, up to four pets are allowed in any property.
Yep.
And you've got 21 days to put an objection in as to why a pet is going to damage your property. The fines are also interesting.
Also say on that note as well that the landlord can't unreasonably refuse.
Correct.
I don't know exactly what the terminology
is. No, well, that's right. You've got to put a case forward about, I don't have a fence in the backyard and so the dogs could get out, or, my floorboards are going to get ruined or whatever that might look, it's not going to be easy. But Tim McKibben, who's the New South Wales Real Estate Institute CEO, he said, so we can't rent bid, but there's going to be pet bidding. And what he means by that is that as you put your application in against all the competing applications, you're going to say, and I've got no pets, and I'm willing to sign up to say that I'm not intending to get a pet for my length of tenure.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, and of course, all of the boffins who came up with this legislation and choked us in New South Wales in terms of trying to get out around these things. They didn't think of that one, right?
Yeah.
But there, so that's an interesting one in terms of what plays out there. But it's really clear that we have a legislative group and a regulatory group in New South Wales who is very focused on tenant outcomes and not so much focused on the investor or the small business owner's outcomes. And so we are hoping that the same rules will happen, or the same market dynamics will play out there. We will see less investment and less, and you know, people getting out of that market, because there's still a lot of lack of knowledge in terms of people about knowing about these changes. And for an individual person, the fine is something like $7,900 if you lie. If you are renovating your property, oh, that was the other one, change of use. Change of use, if you switch it over to a different change of use, but if you want to switch it back, you've got to wait 12 months. So they have literally a group of, let's call them tenancy advocates, have got in a room and they've come up with, now let's make sure, then they're going to try and get out. So they've just tried to lock every angle possible for us to run our small business in that state. So it does feel like we are choked.
And then they, to celebrate, they literally ate cake in, where was it, in Pitt Street or something like that, or Martin Place or something.
Our government-funded money that basically runs these tenants' associations decided to celebrate by getting all of the people together and having cake.
Out in the street in public and,
And make no mistake, the agenda is to try and get individuals, you know, mum and dad property investors out of the market and bring in superannuation and big business to basically run mass rental accommodation solutions in this country. It's still going to take decades. So, you know, for that transformation to happen, and again, I don't know how that's going to happen for freestanding houses and even, you know, sort of pocket townhouses or freestanding townhouses or villas and so forth. So it's not going to be an easy fix. And I still, you know, once I try and model what society and what, you know, what the market will do. And I just think that potentially for those who do stay in over the long run, you know, those assets could be a premium asset, because ultimately, you know, the people who do want to rent those ones will be genuine consumers who can afford to rent it and are renting it out of choice, not out of need.
So landlords will face more compliance and accountability. Reforms aren't just focused on tenant rights. They're also there to hold landlords to a higher standard of accountability, with increased paperwork, defined notice periods, and minimum property standards. Some of the common obligations include providing valid documented reasons for ending leases, following standardised bond and reletting rules around break lease tenancies, maintaining properties to minimum standards, which is another one that we did battle here as well, which we had a little small win on.
Yep.
But the impact of that is landlords who are not fully across these requirements risk financial penalties, tenant disputes, or prolonged vacancy periods. So the investor advice from Corinne is stay informed. Legislation is shifting quickly. Ensure you're aware of the changes. Work with knowledgeable property managers, professionals who are across state-specific reforms that can help mitigate compliance risks and handle communication clearly with tenants. Changes in compliance, minimum housing standards, and break lease obligations can impact expected returns. Be sure to factor them in and be proactive with maintenance and on your property management and your property management choice to maintain returns. So, Ben, anything else that you wanted to cover before we go?
No, I'm happy to go to Q&A.
Yeah?
Yep.
So I'll open the floor for, it's up to you guys in terms of if you'd like to ask questions, but also we want to hear if there's any specific challenges that you are facing. It doesn't have to necessarily be here in Victoria, your property management investment, but if there's anything that you'd like to bring to Picker's attention, we'd love to hear it.
It's one that's it's creating me, because I've got to do whatever they are, minimum housing standards.
Right.
At all their properties.
Yep.
But I can't do it at home because I'm getting money.
Yeah.
So my tenants are living in a higher standard house, home, than I can and provide for my family. So if it's a minimum, and one of the avenues to take out is potentially, if it's a minimum housing standard, then it should apply for all houses,
mm-hmm.
not just me as a rental provider.
Yep,
I agree.
But it should be, you know, if smoke detectors every 6 months and interlink, great. Put it everywhere. And we
Yeah.
Yeah, I I spoke at a inquiry, a rental Victorian rental crisis inquiry, and I sat next to a property manager who was telling the stories of, she was a regional property manager, and there's a lot of properties in Ballarat, Bendigo, and all of those areas that they're 100 years old.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, and so the standards and the drafts under doors and all of these other little nuances. And she's saying, she said, I personally have a property that I've removed the tenant from because it doesn't meet the minimum standards. And if, and you know, I know that they're, you know, back in the day where you had properties that were basically in disrepair, that now I've got this property that's actually very comfortable to live in, and I can't let it out because I don't want to have, well, two things. She's got fines, obviously, as the property manager, which is $100,000 fine. So yeah, it's one of those frustrating things. And your alternative is that you either sit on it and land bank it, but you can't afford to do that because you need the income to potentially service the debt, or you're going to have to divest of one or more of those properties. Yes. Just turn the lights on a couple of times, and but no, but that is absolutely true. So, and it's stories like that that coming back to, you know, how you guys can help, is when we get media inquiries, we're looking for those types of stories, right? And the journalists will ring you and they'll tell me what you mean. Well, yeah, so you know, the house that I have to live in is not getting the maintenance that it needs because the properties that my tenants are living in are in a better standard.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good story, right? You know, that's now ultimately they might say, well, you know, obviously you've got a choice to sell it, but it's like, yes, but I invested or I'm running my small private rental accommodation business, and I need a surety and understanding in terms of the legislation and so forth is going to allow me to keep running my business instead of choking me out of business, you know, in terms of that. And there is a social good that does come out of providing rental accommodation. They might say no, but I just, you know, but you could argue absolutely that, you know, in terms of that economic mobility and all of those things that I talked about earlier, is the reason why we do need a stock of rental accommodation and choice in an open and free market. And we just don't have that.
Property manager can't lease out the one that meets standards.
No, it didn't meet the standards. So her property slightly didn't meet the standards. And because she's a property manager, she was at risk of obviously also breaching her obligations as a property manager. So she would have been fined tens of thousands of dollars.
But it was a client's property.
No, it was her own. Yeah, but she was still acting as the property manager. Well, yeah, but then they run the risk because they haven't done the compliance work. Because one of the things with the compliance work is because now there's in New South Wales, again, the fines are in the tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars for the property managers for breaches. I was saying the individual fee is on your property in a trust or a company, it's $28,000.
Yeah.
Right, so, you know, they'll, because it's 60, you know, points as per those classic sort of. That's in New South Wales. That's the new one that just dropped.
In Victoria, it's 11,000.
It's 11,000 in Victoria. There you go.
If your property is not compliant.
Yeah. For the actual owner. Yeah.
So circle back to something you just said, then, Ben. We often do have media come to us asking for
all the time
people to stand up and have their say. On the tenant side, they're easy to, you know, you can find them everywhere, and they'll tell you exactly what's going on and how bad things are. But it's funny, property investors just don't want to do it, right? So we really do urge you to stand up and have that say. It's not there to go and tell the media how many properties you own. We're not asking for that. But
with retirees, are they supposed to be spending that money? Because you keep saying that they're going to be spending this and on this. Well, what are they supposed to do with that money?
What is your question? It's whatever they want to do with it? Is that what or are you saying that?
The fact that they're spending the kids' inheritance, but what are they supposed to do with it otherwise if they don't spend it themselves?
That's right.
To the kids.
That's his point.
I mean, look, In our business, obviously, we get to see thousands of clients, and we understand that's part of the conversations we have around the property planning side is like, what's the plan? Do we want to have some money left over for the children, or are we going to spend the kids' inheritance? In other words, and so that's a personal choice. And so ultimately, for some people, they will want to set their children up, you know, to and their grandchildren up. God, you know, in terms of my, I never got any money out of my old man, and now he's throwing money at my boys, and God, it makes it hard for them to do their chores and, you know, to earn pocket money and all that. But by the by, but the point being is that that's, you know, that's the choice of working hard and taking risks and, you know, being an aspirational Australian. And I, so, you know, where is superannuation to your point, if you're talking about that, obviously there's a mandated 4% sell down or spend out of super, because that's what that money was for. Super is about, you know, if you talk about the government of the day, a dignified retirement. So, you know, that's what they've tried to mandate. So they're allowed to spend that money. But at the end of the day, you know, generational wealth, and being able to build up that and providing for your next generation, the generation, the generation, that should be something that we should be aspiring to, not necessarily something that should be taken away from us in property taxes, death taxes, or any other type of tax. Because if we don't spend it, the government tries to take it from us.
Yeah, even unrealized.
Yeah, it's an interesting one.
Any other questions at all?
The death tax, that's obviously an American thing.
And UK.
UK. Is it a real thing? We're gonna see it here?
Well, again, it's about the political will in on the day. And if you continue to keep providing more and more services to more and more people, you need more and more revenue. And so where would you get that revenue from? So, yeah, an inheritance tax, death tax.
What does it look like in the US and the UK? Are they similar to each other?
It's a good question. I'm not completely across the US model, but in terms, and the UK model, I've got a brief understanding of it. But, yeah, so if you, I think the home itself to a certain value is protected. So, and if they move into the home, but if, that, so similar, we've got something similar here. If in Australia, if the house is bequeathed to you and you make it your principal place of residence, I think within 12 months, and someone correct me here, I'm not, okay, super across it. So 2 years now, thank you. There we go. So you've got 2 years to transfer that. But if it's sold and so forth, then there's a capital gains event. And so in a sense, that's effectively a death tax. Yeah.
What if it's not the family home that passed on an investment property and they keep it as an investment property?
Yeah, there's some good ones there. I was talking to Julia about this. If it's
we're right in saying there's still got to be a prof, like an exit at some point for that to be taxed though. No,
it's similar to the unrealized gains.
Yeah,
it's similar to our capital gains tax. 50% is not considered, the other half is taxed.
Oh yeah,
that's taxed at the
marginal
deceased person's finishing tax rate.
Correct.
The person who inherits it.
And the
dad was on £150,000 and his tax rate was right up there, and you're on £28,000. You're paying dad's tax rate, not yours.
On the proceeds of the divestment.
You want to make sure they retired.
Because it's a tax on death. And
yes, that's right. So it creates almost a forced sale. Yeah. That's exactly, and that's by design. You know, it's sort of similar to, you know, the unrealized gain strategy that they're trying to force. You know, it forces the liquidation of those assets to pay the tax.
Does the same thing apply to shares?
Oh no, this new, yeah, this, you know, sort of 3 million, the unrealized gains, you know, 100% increase in the tax from 15% to 30%. I was going to pick up on one of those points. I'm trying to. Julia Hartman basically gave us a little tip the other week around joint tenants and tenants in common. I'm going to see if I remember this correctly, Ivis. But if it's a joint tenant, the cost base doesn't get reset on the transfer, but if it's tenants in common, then the cost base can get reset to zero at the time that the asset's transferred from the estate.
Sure.
So there's a little bit of gold there
in terms of
how you estate plan. My understanding is joint tenants and tenants in common aren't a stamp duty event in most capital cities. Joint tenants, or is it the other way around? Have I said that the right way? Yeah. Yeah. So that's just a bit of estate planning that you want to talk to your accountant about. If there is an event where you are going to bequeathing it into the estate potentially resets the capital, the cost base, which should be interesting.
Are there more tenants now through new skills migrants or away from the overseas students?
Yeah, I was mentioning before that because of the cap on international students, we're seeing less demand for rental accommodation in Melbourne. I think it's reported around 42,000 less international students. So the reality, that's taken a bit of pressure off the rental market, especially in the apartment market in the city and on the city fringes. And when you're also down at Caulfield or, you're over, sort of Malvern and Hawthorne in those areas as well, that's sort of taken a bit of pressure off those particular markets.
Because they don't
buy
the cap will come off.
No, they introduced the cap. And even though it wasn't a housing policy, it sort of had intended consequences to take a bit of pressure off the housing market for that particular reason. Because we know that it's a $50 billion industry for this country. So it's massive, and it's a dumb decision when you think about the greater good. And the Victorian state government, there's a lot of money for jam that they're missing out on there. So that they all, so the only thing I've seen them argue with the federal government about because of that. But the byproduct of that is that rents are easing at the moment. But once that equalises again, we'll start to see those rents hopefully increase.
Back of tradies, is that true? Because for apprenticeships, 400 youngies apply for a typical one vacancy of a traineeship or apprenticeship.
Yep.
So that tells me it's inaccurate, that it's false, that there's lack of new people coming through or not enough.
There was a stat that came out during the election campaign about free TAFE and, those positions in free TAFE. And the stat was something like, and I hope some of my might have the right number here, but it was something as high as 28% or something of the people who start
don't complete. Yeah.
And it might have even been higher.
So I think one of the anecdotally they're saying it's really hard to get trades, but specifically around residential builds and things like that, a lot of trades here in Victoria are going to those big government backed projects. So, and we're seeing similar things up in Queensland as well. So it is definitely harder to get those trades, and to try to bring them back onto jobs that aren't government backed is really hard from a labour perspective. Like cost wise, they just can't compete.
Like the free tape course.
It wasn't an upfront payment.
Because they could just sign up for 6 months, or they could sign up for a 2-year TAFE course and then go 3 weeks in and never turn up again.
Never turn up.
Yeah, the government will be subsidised that student and they get full cash for that.
Oh, 100% they do. 100% they do.
Which business is going to take on the trenches to a high value proposition right here for 400. On the flip side, and then you want to come with me and do a training course, you'll come here, I'll give you 500 cash and they get whatever.
Yeah.
Good earner. It doesn't solve
the problem. But what we also know in the data about skilled trade labor, of the 700,000+ people that arrived in this country through the immigration program, it was reported something along the lines of 11,000 people were tradies.
Yes.
And that was by design from the unions to try and ensure that the labour shortages and the higher wages for locals was maintained.
Mm.
So that's again, that's the trade-off you get with whichever political party's in power. When Labor's in power, the unions will always get preferential treatment. And when Liberal's in power, they would want to get the unions out.
When people say they can hire the trades, it's only because they choose not to hire those who name too high a price. So that's why they can't hire enough people. That's because I choose to not hire them, because it's too unreasonably high for what the job is.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've had anecdotal evidence of builders that have got so much work, but customers are pleading for them to put a quote in, and so they load the quote up to stupid price that it's crazy for them not to find a way of doing the job because the margins are so great. And that says to us that, yeah, the model's broken because, you know, we've just got, and, you know, to Tim's point before, when you've got so many construction projects on the go, like we have in our big build here in Victoria at the moment, and they're getting paid a fortune. And so ultimately, you know, these builders can't compete with the hourly rates that are being paid on these ticketed union jobs. And so that's when you get that imbalance and market imbalance, and you get the consequences of, you know, cost of construction and all that just goes through the roof. So not ideal.
What's going to happen with the Trump
effect?
Anything?
The economy and property. I don't know if you've been watching the share market. It's been a bit more turmoil there.
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Yeah,
it's a moment by moment call with him.
Yeah, I think 4 years of uncertainty.
For the property investments, more so than shares, then.
Mate, I mean, traditionally, as interest rates go down, we usually see a trend towards property. So we might, and because the conditions look pretty favourable, we've got a severe under supply.
Yeah, that's
okay. We've got incentives around 5% deposits, which is increasing the demand levels. As interest rates come down, affordability improves. So I suspect you'll see that the new level of property will be higher in the next 12 months to 24 months, broadly speaking, because of those metrics.
I think if you just look back to COVID, when, you know, we've got all the media headlines saying that the economists are expecting the property markets to drop by 20%, and we saw, you know, 20% in the opposite direction, so 40% wrong. They said the same thing as soon as we started to see interest rate rises. And through all of this, you know, the Australian markets continue to grow really strongly. And it's because of the shortfall in housing. You know, it's a necessity. You know, it's got to keep on going up if we don't have, I mean, I can't say that across all of Australia, but I'm saying as a generalisation, when you don't have enough housing and you've got demand for the housing and we've got a rising population, I can't see that it can go any direction but up as a generalisation.
I'll give you this one. So I work for a council, a regional council, and there's a lot of discussion around a four-day work week. So how does an increase in productivity occur when we're going to potentially going to a four-day work week?
Doesn't quite compute, does it?
They mentioned 12-hour days.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll argue that on that day off, they'll go and work a second job and add more productivity because there's really no other, yeah.
Uber driver on Wednesday.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I don't know how that works. But, I mean, but that just, again, it's anecdotal of, the society, we're a rich country, and so, you know, one of our challenges is how do we remain competitive and sustain our economic prosperity if we continue to keep being lazy and expect to continue to get government handouts when things get tough. So we're getting really into sort of some big theory there. I wanted to pick up on the point you were just making before about that sort of rising tide lifting all ships, and I'm just trying to think what I was. I've just had a mental blank. One of the things, that's what it was. If you study some of the other more expensive cities and property markets around the world, what you will find is, irrespective of the taxation settings, if the city is a financial hub or a major economic center that has a lot of knowledge workers in industries and health, technologies, those types of things, STEM industries, you do get very expensive land value and you get very expensive property prices overall. And so that just is a testament to what I was saying before. And I'll give you a classic, sort of hypothetical example. A young couple come into our office and, they're really excited that they've saved a deposit and they're ready to buy their first home. And they've done their budget at home and that's all good. And, they've told us that, can we just get a pre-approval to buy a $500,000 property? We say, sure, no worries. So we, pick the lender and off we go and we get the pre-approval. Now, they've obviously been looking on the search engine portals and, they're seeing all these properties pop up on the $500,000 search range. And then they finally go out and start doing their own research. And they realize pretty quickly that a $500,000 property is not what they've been seeing online. And it's not what they've been selling for out in the field. And so all of a sudden, they realize that it's maybe $560,000 that's going to get them the property. And they're having a debate with themselves around, how much lower do we want to go on our standards, or how much further do we want to go out in terms of that? We refer to it as a buyer's decision quadrant in terms of that. And in most cases, what they will do is they'll go back to their broker and say, you said we could probably borrow a bit more. How much more could we borrow? And so if you think about that and you think about the investor who can also come in and say, well, just, it's a $480,000 property. Just give them another $10,000 and let's be done with it, right? That is true. And that's what, is that pumps up really affordable markets quickly. So what you've got to be realizing is that in the dynamics in that particular market, that the people will run to their value. And if they can afford it, then that's where the prices will settle, because it's not a live active market, right? And unfortunately, there's irrational activities and that. Now, in the perfect market hypothesis, it's meant to be argued that, price will always find share price will always basically find its fair value because it's the perfect hypothesis. But if that is the case, well, what do share prices move? And all of those things are judged. So, but in a property space, because it's an essential need as well, you will always see property prices grow as quick as the opportunity for the demand in that particular area. And so when you get low interest rates, borrowing power goes up, and that's the level you were talking about. Yeah, it'll just, the tide will rise to that level. But what a lot of people also, and the commentators, and you'll see this especially in, ill-informed commentators and journalists, they will say, well, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it was only 6x earnings to buy this current home. Now it's 13x earning. It's, how do people afford these properties? Well, they're completely dismissing that when you do the analysis on incomes to property prices, there's not a super strong correlation, right? There's a definite correlation, but because that's borrowing power and so forth. But what you're not factoring into that is, what about the downgrader who just sold their $1.3 million dollar property, and they just want something. They just want a $780,000 tenants. So PEXA reported last year that 25% of all property transactions are paid in cash. So
a lot of them are broadbeach too.
Exactly. And so what? That's the market dynamic at work there. In terms of, I can potentially bring proceeds of sale. I can potentially bring proceeds of inheritance. And we saw a research paper out a couple of weeks back that the average inheritance in Australia right now is $706,000. So if I'm getting $706,000 and I've got my $500,000, And I've gone through my little property buying exercise of getting my entry-level property and then getting my next home and then trying to get my forever home. Well, I'm not borrowing that full amount. I might have been able to pocket 500,000 of that. And so technically I'm only borrowing $1 million for my $1.5 million house. But the commentators don't see it like that. They just go, who can afford a 1.4 million, you know, like 80%? They keep working back to this 80%.
Yeah.
But that's just not how the market works. The market has buyers in there that have different markets and different budgets. And that's it's an emotional asset. And everyone has this concept that property prices always keep going up. And while that remains the true, at the end of the day, a property is worth what someone's willing to pay for it. Right. And, you know, is this bottle of water worth what it is in my hand, which is basically nothing? Or, you know, if this is a Jordan bottle of water and, you know, Michael Jordan's drunk out of this water, someone's potentially willing to pay $5,000 for the remaining bottle, right, and put it into a truck. So, again, that's market. That's an open market basically trying to determine price of an item. The scarcer the item, usually the greater the price.
Do a tax webinar earlier in the year, and it was the premise or question was, if the government or the Melbourne Water or someone puts a levy on the property, will that get passed on to the purchaser? Instantly my mind went, of course it will, you know, I'm in land development, yeah, of course it will. But then the whole, you know, 2-day seminar was boiled down to that fact, is the market will dictate the price.
Yes it will, but when 41% of the property prices are taxes, right? You know, like at the end of the day, let's look at what's happening in Cairns. It's in terms of to build in Cairns today, you know, in terms of medium and high density and all of that, it's just so expensive to build up there that no one will buy it. Right? Like so the market is telling you that I'm not going to pay that sort of price. So when you're looking at some of the assets up there, you're like, you're buying back in the day, you're buying for under replacement cost, right? Because it was just like, you just couldn't build this for the same sort of price. So, well, that's a pretty low risk investment, right? So you've got to to the point where everyone will sort of say the same sort of thing. If there was a lot more rental properties and less demand for rent, the market will find its price. And that is true in the short term. Supply and demand will always judge, you know, and you could argue in the long term it's the same thing. But what sustains growth over the long term is the economic activity, because it moves the dial on what people can afford. So that's why everything still comes back to the economy and what's happening in that local economy for sustainable growth.
Is there still... Oh, sorry.
Just ask one help back again to the rental reforms.
Yeah.
In relation to what Peter Devon was able to speak to, because the opposition or the party as minister saw it, and was there much feedback there? Yeah, pressure, or was it just I wasn't across the numbers in terms of the House, but federal is not through the prior.
So the New South Wales legislation?
No, is... Victorian for the recent.
Yeah.
Reforms?
Yes.
And any input or voice in terms of trying to get some pushback or
trying
to have it as a controllable asset as opposed to, basically controlled steer by the reforms?
We formed in 2017, Pika. The reform agenda in the rental space sort of started, I think, around 2015, 2016, 2017. And by the time that I look back through the so-called reviews that were happening, most of them were completed by late 2017. The legislation came in March of 2020. So it does take a bit of time because there was 133 reforms. So unfortunately, we were asleep and no one was really, you know, fighting the good fight.
Because I remember you mentioning on a podcast that rather than wording 10-year and so on.
Yeah.
And that just
and
just weren't able to get in to provide the evidence and why certain things were going to be very challenging.
And yeah, so now that's obviously the
asking.
Yeah, well, so it was March 2020 in terms of, you know, so it was back when we probably weren't organised at the sort of level that we are. In terms of the the Standing Committee on the Rental Crisis and so forth. So I spoke at that live event in concert with the Property Council of Australia, who were also warning about the negative consequences of the reforms and what needed to be done to fix the rental crisis. In terms of where we get political traction, I've met with the Commissioner of Rental in Victoria. That took me almost 9 months to get that meeting. The Liberal Party absolutely have a listening ear, and they were the ones who helped us get a seat to speak at that standing committee inquiry.
We're doing a joint paper with the RIB.
Yeah, and we're doing a joint paper with the Real Estate Institute of Victoria. In fact, it surprised me a little bit around their lack of knowledge around, you know, the challenges.
Because I'm just stunned at just local feedback from members. There's just nothing there to counteract or to say, look, what they're just what the opposition have put in place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then for the local elections, this is what we're going to nothing. I was just close to emailing the local member and saying, what the heck, you guys, are you aware of this?
Yeah. Look, I think that the squeaker's cog gets the most oil, right? So to your point, that's exactly what we need you to be doing, is asking the question, because they surely it's in the data now. Like, we've got the data that can back us to say, we told you that the rental market would collapse in terms of supply. We haven't seen the secondary element of that, which is high rents. But, well, we have seen significantly high, but we want to keep pushing that higher. So, no, if you can do a grassroots movement in terms of that. So Michael Sukkar and we've spoken to some of the others, but you know, now he's lost his seat. So unfortunately, it is a bit of a reset in terms of that.
On that, you mentioned Sky Vision. Yep, I have one of those sticks. Where can I get a stick that says I'm a landlord and I vote?
Yeah. That's right. That's what we've been talking about. Yeah.
Since they're going, you mentioned RAIB. I assume we all use agents and those sorts of things to help us manage. But this united voice, I suppose, I'm sitting there going,
It's got to come from here, because at the end of the day, the RAIB is supporting the agents.
Yep.
Right. We need to speak up, and we need this. You know, we're $5 a membership. Yep. We need to be able to get that in front of a lot more people, because the louder our voice is, the more that they'll listen. But at the moment, you know, I mean, I don't want to say they don't listen, but we get a chance to speak. But if we're not noisy enough, they're not going to react to it. And politically palatable as well to be able to be seen to be looking after landlords in favour of tenants. But what we're arguing is that the decisions that you're making are actually having these unintended consequences, and they're actually affecting the very people you set out to look after in the first place.
So we've got about 3,000 members, and that needs to be about 50,000 members to make a meaningful national change. Yeah.
Without a marketing budget, because you're a not-for-profit, it's not easy to get the word out, and hence we're sitting in Reservoir tonight with 30 people. We want that to be 300 next time.
Yeah. but in terms of things like putting a bumper sticker and those types of things together, it's if we had the distribution and the money to basically do it, like as I said, we all volunteer our time. No one earns a dollar for the volunteer work we do, and it costs us about $11,000 a year to run our compliance, our liability insurances, our CRM, and we're collecting $5 for 1 year and basically $25 for 5 years. So our fees have to go up, because you know we've had to kick in personally to keep it viable. That's part of that, you know, in terms of if we get a little bit more money through donations or through, you know, new people joining, we can do a little bit more. But at the moment, we're...
To get to reach out, so have you discussed the ability to set up the sponsorship rather than maybe just decide the non-for-profit, which I understand, but given who we're trying to get a compete against, taxpayer-funded bodies...
Yeah.
In addition to what I mentioned, the Liberal Party, in addition, I know you're going to other states, but there needs to be abroad. There's a lot more than 3,000 investing out in the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, what my original intention was is that PIPA, being the trade association, you know, I'd like to see the industry and the businesses support that and put sponsorships and all of that sort of stuff behind that. And then it would be nice if they would give us a donation each year to help us run, because what's going to happen if we decide to open it up to take corporate sponsorship is that, you know, the risk we run politically is that when we go in a campaign and we say, oh, look, you know, we represent the landlord, the property investor, and they go, but your major sponsor is a developer, or your major sponsor is realestate.com, like, and all of a sudden it's like, and it just dilutes a little bit of our messaging. And so I've been really conscious about the optics in terms of that. But at some point, for the association to continue to keep growing, we might just have to.
We're looking at some strategic partnerships with some other communities as well that are in a similar space, develop other, you know, private developers and things like that.
Yeah.
But
referring to is just local trades, building suppliers. All that people need as investors need to know, who can I get from where?
Yeah.
Could be from that level. They're not major organizations, they're small business that are supporting or getting their brands out in various.
That's true. So, yeah, no. That's a good question. You get a book.
Yeah, that's it. There's this might be a good time. Sorry, one more.
Percentage of builders and tradesmen own investment properties. Because they may not be interested in joining this if they don't own any.
That's all about that. Them, us giving them work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sponsorship, you want to get your name out there and things like that. So it's a lot of things. Sorry.
Land tax. I've been investing for 33 years and I don't remember land tax ever being a thing at the start. Is there a percent of your rental income that it should be about? Because we're finding it really bizarre, even identical apartments with completely different land tax bills.
Oh, really? From your.
Say anything in case they get adjusted up.
Is the entity any different in that? Because we've heard. No.
Two up, two down. So fair enough if they were higher or they were four completely different amounts.
And so what I mean, the ownership of the units, all exactly the same.
Yep.
I thought it was high, like for a two-bedroom apartment, between 6,000 and 8,000. Then my husband got land tax bill for a house, and he goes, "Oh, it was so high, it was 5,000." I'm like, "Well, how's that five if the apartments and like, this is there? A, how do they?
Oh,
it doesn't make sense."
So it's
rent. Should it be? Is there a sum where you think, oh, it could be a month's rent, 3 months' rent?
No, there's no rule of thumb on it. So there's, you know. Back in the day, the threshold was over $300,000, and now it's down to $50,000. Right? So it's the unimproved value of the land in terms of which it's set, and that's determined by the valuer general of the state. And so
same.
I know it's fascinating, isn't it? Just to show you that yeah, no, don't own up to it. Not if it's in your favour.
Right, which is wrong, but
well,
valuations on your
property. You can get valuations. Yeah, so the rates notice from the valuer general sets your rates, and then ultimately it's off the back of that you're also sent to the state revenue office. The state revenue office works out whether you're over the threshold, and then the dollar value kicks in at is it 970, and then it's plus $1 every something or other off the back of that. There's a calculation in there in terms of how much is it?
$975.
Thank you. $975 is the minimum you pay, and then it kicks up off the back of that. But in terms of as a rule of thumb of what your costs are,
we've got a brochure on it in the PIPA members portal as well.
Which getting started because multiple properties and there's also an extra business
correct
on top of that as well. That might be why there's a break.
Yeah. You, if you own It's a combination of
total land value.
Correct. It's total land value in an individual's name or an entity's name. And back in the day, the trust entities, it kicks in basically. There was no threshold.
Mm.
So, and in some cases, it's slightly higher for company and trusts.
Finding it that the land tax is just out of control.
Yeah.
You can potentially, you know, dispute the valuation on the property.
It's a huge expense. Yeah. And like you say, people say, oh, you're a greedy landlord or you've got more than one property.
Yeah.
But then the tenants don't realise all the fire and all the detective stuff you're doing, the land tax bills.
Yeah.
They don't see that.
No.
It's like having a small business and the staff say, oh, the money's coming.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cost's going out, right? Yep.
Yeah.
Maybe if some of the tenants knew what the bills were. And the other side of it that I think, I'm not a tenant, but I feel for the tenants is, when we get the update of the property, I think the photos are quite personal. And I think the photos of the internal of your property should be the lights, the walls, not the bed and things like that. Like, I'm getting them where there's people's knickers on the floor, and I think that's a bit of an invasion of privacy. And I don't need to see that as a landlord.
Well, in South Australia, it won't be happening. They won't let you take the photo without their permission.
Was renting and they're coming once or twice a year to take photos of their bedroom.
In fairness, they're getting given them, you know, ample notice to pick the knickers up as well, though.
It's all the privacy.
Yeah.
Change your property manager.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, some landlords are debt-free on their properties, and those tenants can be very lucky in terms of getting a good deal or maybe a fair deal or whatever that looks like. But, you know, in certain instances, if, you know, in my case, my interest bill went over $100,000 through the run of, you know, all the properties that I've got. And so, you know, and I think I increased rents by around $33,000 over that period.
Mm.
So the rest was borne, you know, by, you know, my household. So that is, you know, part and parcel of, you know, what's happening in terms of, so. But coming back to Ben's point before is that you can test by putting your rents up, and then the market will accept that or not.
Mm.
And I think what I always want to make sure that my property manager is doing is, you know, if I'm experiencing this, and that's what I've had to do, I've had to put rents up considerably across the portfolio. But as interest rates come down, I may not have to do that. And, you know, for the 3 or 4 years before, where interest rates were super cheap, I didn't touch any rents.
Mm.
I was very happy, you know, in terms of that. Even through the moratorium where, you know, we couldn't do anything. We couldn't remove, like, you know, I think we've been fair and reasonable in terms of that. But the reality is the cost of running our business has gone up. We've got two choices. We go out of business or we put our costs up to our customers. And if we can't put our costs up, we go out of business.
Yeah.
And going out of business,
then there's
the capital gains.
Yep.
And
that's the choice of being in business. And that's why it is a small private rental accommodation business.
Yeah.
And yes.
Sorry, is the turnover of property managers quite high?
Yeah, it's a tough gig, right?
So they lack attention to detail. They're not practical enough.
I'd be careful. There's a few in the room. on that note, I'm going to start to wind things up.
Land tax is an observation, I suppose. If I was a federal politician and I'm sitting there saying there's a $5,000 tax deduction, you go around the room, how many thousands of, how many billions of dollars is the federal government losing in, because we've now got a valid land tax bill?
Yeah, in other words, which is tax deductible. Yeah.
Surely somebody at some stage is going to go, hey, guys, this is...
I have had an even better idea about a national titles.
That's true.
Not going to happen in our lifetime, unfortunately.
Yeah, look, we're going to wrap things up. We'll have a bit of a chance to walk around and have a chat, and Ben and I will be here for another 5 or 10 minutes, but they are going to start to kick us out pretty soon. So just want to obviously thank everybody for coming. As you can tell by tonight's conversation, you know, things are moving rapidly in this space, and as a community, we really got to get together, spread the word, and obviously try to get, if you're not a member, get a brochure from me before you go. I've got a QR code somewhere on there.
If you're a property manager, get all your tenants to be members.
Yeah, exactly. But if you can get, it's $5 and we are going to be putting it up. So if you jump in and get a membership with us soon, you'll save some money there as well. I think it's $5 for a year or 20 for 5 years. So you can get a good deal there. Can everybody join me in a round of applause for Ben sharing his insights and also Ben and Ritesh for all their assistance as well. Yeah.
So, and you can make the decision on who gets the other book.
Okay, well, you've given one over here and also some really good questions over here. And if you're lucky enough, you might even get a signature on them from Ben. So thank you, everybody, and drive safe.
Thank you.